Welcome to Module 5 of the Evidence-Driven Teacher Evaluation Certification Program. This final module in the program is entitled Leveraging Time and Effort for Maximum Impact. And this is where we're going to talk about some of the strategies that can free up the time that it takes to do effective evaluations. So let's start by taking a look back at where we have been throughout this program. We started with an introduction on some myths and misconceptions about the teacher evaluation process. Then in Module 1, we started with goal setting for teacher growth. In Module 2, we talked about how instructional frameworks can serve as growth pathways for teachers. In Module 3, we talked about the formal observation process and discussed the evidence-driven approach to formal observations. In Module 4, we talked about final evaluations and using the GSIR format to rate teacher performance and write airtight final evaluations. And now in Module 5, we'll talk about maximizing our impact by leveraging time and effort in creative ways so that we're putting our time and effort toward the things that will make the greatest difference. So here's a little bit of what we'll talk about in this module. We'll talk about prioritizing based on risk and uncertainty, not just known performance issues. We'll talk about how to use the bucket strategy a bit more, which we've talked about throughout this program, so that we can reuse written language for multiple teachers whenever it applies, while still ensuring that each teacher gets an accurate and unique overall evaluation. We'll talk about differentiating using the Pareto principle or the 80-20 rule, and why we might need to spend dramatically more time on some evaluations. We might need to put more effort into some of them, and why we can prioritize and differentiate and free up that time by streamlining our other evaluations. We'll talk about the three risk factors that introduce the possibility of unexpected performance issues and how we can keep those from sneaking up on us. And we'll talk about what to do with any performance issues that are not resolved at the end of the year. So thank you for going on this journey with me through the Evidence-Driven Teacher Evaluation Certification Program. Welcome to Module 5. Let's get started. Cutting back on unnecessary writing. Let's start by talking about one of our biggest opportunities to free up bandwidth and save time in the teacher supervision and evaluation process, and that is to simply eliminate writing that we do not need to do. There is already so much writing required in the teacher evaluation process that it's a bit absurd how much time we spend doing extra writing that we are not required to do. So one of my first recommendations for you is to really think about what writing you have to do and what the audience for that writing is. In most cases, the only audience for your evaluation writing is the individual teacher. Of course, each teacher will go to their mailbox or open the evaluation you give them and read it. They might skim it, they might read it carefully, they might put it immediately in a drawer after they read it, but they're probably going to at least skim it. But they may be the only person whoever reads it. It's confidential. You're not going to give it to many other people. In some cases, human resources or your supervisor or perhaps a union rep might read an evaluation if it is negative, if it's contested, if it's high stakes in some way. But for the most part, a very small number of people are going to read your evaluations, typically no more than two or three or four people in addition to the teacher. So I'm going to recommend that we don't put a lot of effort into any type of writing that we don't have to, right? We want to do good evaluations. Every teacher deserves a good final evaluation from us, but they don't need a lot of extra stuff. So we want to focus on what we're actually required to do. So this is where you look at your district expectations, talk to your supervisor, talk to human resources, and ask, what am I actually required to write? And then do a good job of that and don't go beyond it. In most cases, you are required to take some sort of written documentation of practice, and that would be observation notes. And of course, I've encouraged you in this program to take good low inference notes while you're observing lessons in the classroom. If you are required to write a post-observation report, of course, do that. If you're required to fill out a form, of course, do that. But if you're not, don't feel compelled to write a post-observation report. I believe there is much more value in talking with the teacher, having a genuine two-way conversation where you can discuss the evidence and ask good questions. There's much more value in that than in doing unnecessary writing. When it comes to the final evaluation, presumably you have to do something. You have to fill out a form, you have to write a report, perhaps both, but don't do anything that you don't have to do. Do not create extra documents and extra work for yourself. And I wouldn't be making such a big deal out of this, except I recently spoke with a school that described their process for me. They described both the formal process and its requirements and everything else they were doing as part of the supervision and evaluation process. And the amount of writing that they were doing was just immense. And it was taking dozens of hours a week for their administrators to keep up with this self-imposed workload. So look at your requirements and stop doing writing that you do not have to do. One type of writing that you may be surprised that you don't actually have to do is providing written feedback. Written feedback is often not required at any stage of the process. And personally, I'm not a fan of written feedback. I believe that feedback should be almost entirely a conversation, because that's where we have the opportunity to really change teacher practice through face-to-face conversation. Some of the drawbacks of written feedback and some of the reasons I hope you'll reconsider spending much time on written feedback are first that it takes so much time. It is vastly more time consuming to sit down with your computer and write out feedback versus just talking with the teacher. It's also much harder for the teacher to really hear, right? In a face-to-face conversation, you can get your message across, you can adjust your message based on how the teacher is reacting, but in writing, you don't have that ability to adapt in real time, and you run the risk of saying things in a way that the teacher is not really going to listen to or benefit from. It's also quite possible that your feedback will simply be off target, that you will have misunderstood what you were seeing or misunderstood where the teacher's thinking and practice really are. So the feedback may not actually be helpful, even if the teacher is receptive to it. Fourth, feedback is not really a form of evidence. We want this to be an evidence-driven process, but feedback is something slightly different from evidence. So there's not a whole lot of evidentiary value in giving feedback. And we do have to be careful on the evidence question when it comes to feedback that we've given in writing that the teacher has then implemented. If the teacher has responded to that feedback and has made changes to their practice, and we documented in the past that they needed to, and then they can document in the present that they have done so, well, that may work against us in a negative evaluation. So we need to be very careful about written feedback. And if I could encourage you to focus just on one thing that you give teachers after an observation, again, do whatever is required in your organization, but I would recommend simply sharing your notes from the observation, your low inference notes that you took on paper, in a Google Doc, in repertoire, however you take notes, simply share those with the teacher and eliminate every other type of writing that you are allowed to eliminate. And that is going to save you more time than almost anything else. But we've got quite a bit more to go in Module 5 to save you time and effort and help you multiply the impact of the time and effort that you do invest in teacher evaluations. Identifying your high-risk teacher evaluations. Let's talk now about how we can identify teachers who may be at higher risk in the evaluation process. Because what we're going to do is we're going to differentiate the time and effort we put into their evaluations just to make sure things are okay. What we're not going to do after identifying our high-risk teachers is we're not going to give them a different process. And for teachers who are not high-risk, we're not going to skip any steps in the process. Everyone is going to get the fair, consistent process that's already been laid out. We're not going to skip any steps or double up on any steps for anyone, but we can differentiate our time and effort based on risk. And risk is a useful concept here because sometimes we don't have direct information of underperformance, right? If someone is obviously struggling, well, that's solid information, but sometimes it's the lack of information that is the real problem. We just don't know how someone is doing. Maybe they're new to us. There are a variety of different factors that we're going to look at. And those all factor into how we allocate our time and effort in the evaluation process. So what does it mean for someone to be high risk? Of course, one obvious risk is that they will get an unsatisfactory final evaluation, some sort of negative outcome in the evaluation process. It could also be that regardless of their evaluation, they resign at the end of the year. They choose not to come back. Maybe they take a different job. Maybe they leave the profession entirely. That would be a pretty substantial risk. They could be at risk of developing performance problems in the future or over time. They could be at risk of engaging in some serious form of misconduct, you know, like doing something inappropriate with a student, or they could just be a little bit unpredictable in some way. High risk, though, does not mean there is any immediate specific reason for concern. We don't necessarily have to have direct evidence in order to consider someone high risk. And for that reason, we don't need to inform anybody necessarily. This is just a designation in our own minds that causes us to pay more attention and to be more thoughtful and to be more alert and to be more careful. So how do we identify people who are at higher risk, especially if we don't have much evidence yet? I want to share with you now three main risk factors, and those are being new, having new responsibilities, and facing new challenges. So let's talk about people who are new. You might have people who are fresh out of college, maybe they're career changers, maybe they're working with students for the first time, and because they're new, they don't have much of a track record. We don't have much of a sense of what to expect from them. They may also lack experience, certification, professional training, right? If they are new, they may be coming in without a traditional teacher preparation program. Or they may be experienced to some extent, but teaching a new grade level, or they may be working with a new population that presents different challenges to them. It could also be that they are working alone in their department. If they're a singleton teacher, or if your curriculum is very teacher determined and there isn't much of a pathway for people to follow, there could be kind of a lack of structure and accountability. And if that is new for someone, even if they are not new to the profession, that could be a challenge for them. But it's not just new people who can be high risk. It can also be your veteran staff, your mid-career staff, your later career staff, who just may be going through some things that could affect their performance or at least put them at risk of having performance issues. So let's look at some possible issues for veteran staff. It could be the death of a loved one, or the, you know, for some reason, the departure of someone important in their life, like a divorce or someone passing away. It could be a personal health issue, either a physical or mental health issue that causes them to potentially have performance problems. It could be major changes in their family responsibilities. You know, if an elderly parent is in poor health and has suddenly come to live with them, or if dealing remotely with their parents' healthcare issues has become taxing, that could affect their performance as a teacher. Or it could be a substance abuse issue that does happen. And it doesn't just happen to new people. It can happen to people at any stage of their career. And certainly if someone is struggling with a substance abuse issue, that could be an issue right away. You know, if someone comes to school under the influence of drugs or alcohol, we're of course not going to wait for the final evaluation to deal with that. That would become an immediate misconduct issue, and we would deal with it in a timely fashion. But all of these factors are things to potentially think about when you're considering who might be at higher risk of something happening. And that justifies a greater degree of effort and time and attention in the evaluation process. So in the next section, we'll talk about precisely how we differentiate for high-risk evaluations. Differentiating for high-risk teacher evaluations. Once we have identified our high-risk teacher evaluations, we then need to decide what to do about them, how to handle them differently. And of course, part of that is going to depend on where we are in the school year and where we are in terms of uncertainty and how much evidence we've collected. So the very first thing we need to concern ourselves with is gaining more information and reducing that uncertainty. So continuing to get into classrooms on a consistent basis is going to be a powerful source of information. Having in-depth feedback conversations and conducting thorough formal observations certainly will fill in any gaps in our knowledge about our high-risk teachers. And of course, as we move closer and closer to final evaluation decisions, we need to be looking at multiple sources of evidence. What are the different indicators that tell us how someone is doing? You know, are we getting input from students and parents, evidence from observations? Are we looking at grades? Are we looking at assessments? Are we looking at lessons and curricular materials that teachers are preparing? There are lots of sources of evidence that can give us insight into how someone is doing. And of course, people can tell us how they're doing. If we check in, ask how they're doing, ask how we can support them. You know, closing those gaps in our understanding of each teacher's practice is our first priority. Our second priority is to then start to do something about that. If someone is struggling, if there are specific concerns that are not just risks, but actually substantiated concerns, we need to figure out what those are. We need to identify the precise nature of the performance issues that those teachers are having, continue gathering more information, and then provide support. And that support could take a number of different forms like coaching, professional development, training, and it could involve using official processes like a letter of reprimand or a performance improvement plan or whatever is in place in your district. So we've got to think about what we're going to do consistently for everyone, how we're going to treat everyone the same, as well as how we're going to differentiate for people who are higher risk. But what we're not going to do is create separate processes. We're going to follow the same process for everyone. That is absolutely essential, that we not deviate from the process. As we go through that process, we can put extra effort into collecting evidence and making sure that our ducks are in a row as far as what we're going to say in our evaluations. And one way to do that, as we've talked about throughout this program, is to develop GSIR arguments, to make generalization, specifics, impact, and rating claims, complete arguments, and then see if they really line up, see if we have the evidence to substantiate those claims. We can, of course, continue to do formal observations, but focus them on areas where we don't have enough information, enough evidence, so that we can close those gaps. And of course, we can differentiate by putting extra time and effort into our writing. Now, in this module, we're talking about where to save time, how to save time, and things like that. And one of the primary strategies we've talked about for saving time on evaluations is the bucket strategy. This idea that we can reuse a great deal of our writing in the evaluation process because of similarities between the practice of different teachers. But as we saw when we looked at the Anna Karenina principle, that often doesn't work for teachers who are struggling and not meeting expectations. The Anna Karenina principle is drawn from the first line of Anna Karenina: happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And that means the bucket strategy is not going to allow us to save as much time with those higher risk evaluations. Now, if someone is satisfactory after being, in our mind, high risk because we don't know a lot about them, as that uncertainty turns into certainty and we see that someone is in fact satisfactory, then we may be able to reuse that bucket language using the bucket strategy. But we just don't know in advance, and we need to be ready to allocate more of our time in the evaluation process to those higher risk teachers. Now, one other thing that we can do to differentiate is we can use HR processes. And of course, you want to use your organization's HR processes and protocols, but we also have tools for you in the Principal's HR Toolkit. You know, if you need to put someone on a performance improvement plan, that is part of the process, and it is justified by the process itself. So it is an appropriate form of differentiation in the teacher evaluation process. Same with letters of reprimand, using peer observations and things like that. We want to make sure that we're treating everyone fairly. And if there is a reason to use one of these HR tools, we go ahead and use them. But what we're not going to do to differentiate is add burdensome extra things that are not justified by the process, right? We don't want to do extra formal observations. We don't want to do extra walkthroughs. We don't want to make extra requirements for teachers as part of the evaluation process, even though that would give us more and better evidence, even though it seems justified to say, hey, you know, I have more concerns, so I'm going to require you to do more, or I'm going to come more often. Those are things that will backfire on us, as we'll see when we talk about acting in good faith. So we're going to differentiate in a number of ways, but we're not going to deviate from the process or make it especially burdensome for teachers who are higher risk. In the next section, we'll talk about how to determine how much to write for our high risk evaluations. Writing enough for low and high risk final evaluations. So if we're going to optimize our time usage in the evaluation process, we need to make sure that we're writing enough, but not too much for each teacher's evaluation. And of course, our high risk evaluations are going to take more of our time, but we still need to make sure we're doing the right amount of writing for each teacher. So how much should we write for each evaluation? Well, of course, go with what your organization requires, whatever the expectation is in your school or district, and give the amount of detail that you are expected to give. My general advice on this is to make one GSI argument for each overall domain. So for example, if you use as your evaluation criteria, you would write one GSI argument for each domain. So planning and preparation, classroom environment, and so on. So you would end up with four arguments overall. If, however, someone is unsatisfactory in a particular criterion, you would write a specific GSI argument for that criterion where they are below satisfactory. So if you have no concerns in planning and preparation, but you do have concerns under the domain of classroom environment or classroom management, you would drill down into the specific criteria and write a detailed GSI argument about that specific criterion or those specific criteria where the person's practice is below expectations. And just to kind of recap what GSIR is all about, we've talked about this earlier in the program, but it stands for generalization, specific, impact, and rating. And what this format does is it makes sure you have every piece of the argument. What is this teacher's practice like? We're describing it in a written evaluation. We are backing that description with specific evidence and examples. Then we are explaining why it matters, why it's consequential for, you know, relevant outcomes for student learning and school climate and things like that. And then we're tying that to a specific rating according to your evaluation system. And this draws on some earlier work by John Safier, who called it CEIJ. That's how I first learned about it. But, you know, evidence-based reasoning can be found everywhere, especially in the next generation science standards. You'll see claim, evidence, and reasoning. And what we've done more recently is we've converted that format into the GSIR Final Evaluation Builder. This is a template that you will find in Repertoire. And if you'd like a direct link, you can just go to principalcenter.com/builder and then log into the app, and you will find this builder with drag and drop phrases and multiple choice options for those phrases and fill in fields so that you can update it for each individual teacher to construct those detailed arguments. And you want to do that as soon as possible. Do not wait till the end of the school year to start building those arguments, especially for your high-risk teachers, because in the process of constructing those arguments, you are going to identify gaps in your evidence. You're going to articulate hunches and then realize, okay, I don't quite have all of the evidence I need to substantiate that claim or even determine if my hunch is correct. And just in the act of articulating that argument, you can figure out how to best spend your time from now until the end of the evaluation process. And in doing that, you can also start to identify reusable language. Again, that language is not going to be reusable in areas where people are below satisfactory, but if most people are satisfactory in most things, there's still a substantial opportunity to save time there. And one tool that I want to remind you of is our final evaluation, our teacher evaluation organizer spreadsheet. This is a great place to think through what categories or areas of practice you want to mention in final evaluations. You don't need 10 of them. There's room for quite a few. You probably just need 4 to 6. And then you probably need 3 to 5 buckets to describe different teachers who have different styles in ways that ring true for them. And then of course you'll back those with specific evidence. And this is where a lot of your time savings comes from in writing evaluations. Now there's a little bit of a curve to that time savings. When you start using the bucket strategy and start reusing language, what you're going to find at first is that it actually takes slightly longer to come up with language that will be reusable that you could apply to other teachers' evaluations. And then as you start to actually reuse it for, you know, for that second, third, fourth, fifth teacher who has the similar classroom management style, that's where your savings in time are going to kick in. So it won't feel like you're saving much time at first. Your first couple of evaluations might take longer than usual, but the second half especially are going to go much more quickly. In the next section, we'll talk about what to anticipate and what to be aware of when it comes to negative teacher evaluations and wagon circling behavior. Acting in good faith and preventing wagon circling teacher behavior. Once you begin pursuing a teacher evaluation that might end up negative, if the teacher gets any hint that things might not go their way in the evaluation process, they might start to feel that you are targeting them, and they might even explicitly accuse you of harassing them and targeting them. And there are some predictable reactions on the part of the rest of your staff that when that happens, that we might need to be prepared for. So it's very important to both act in good faith throughout this process and show that you are acting in good faith. Here's what you can expect in terms of wagon circling behavior when you start pursuing a negative teacher evaluation and that comes to the teacher's attention. If other teachers perceive in any way that you are treating one of their colleagues unfairly, they're going to side with that person, even if they know that that person is not a good teacher. You will automatically be the bad guy if you are unfair in any way, even if everyone knows that that teacher is not doing good things for students. And this might not feel fair, but it is the reality because everyone deserves fairness. Everyone knows that if you go after one person, you could go after another person, and they might not necessarily trust that you know the difference between good practice and bad practice, so why might they not be targeted next in their mind? So it's absolutely imperative that we treat people fairly, that we are seen as treating people fairly, and that we just expect some resistance when we pursue a negative evaluation. And you know, even if you do everything right, there is going to be a cost to this. There is going to be a consequence in terms of staff climate from any kind of negative evaluation that you do. And this is where we have to do kind of cost-benefit analysis and say, you know, it's going to be bad for students if I don't address the situation, and it's going to be bad if I do address the situation. So it's kind of a pick-your-poison situation. It's like if you have a knee replacement surgery coming up, you know that you are dealing with a long and painful recovery from that surgery, but you also know if you don't get the surgery, if you don't get the problem fixed, it is going to continue to hurt. It is, you know, you're going to deal with some pain either way, and you have to make a decision as to which is ultimately the better, you know, the better path to take. It may be worth dealing with the consequences of a negative evaluation than allowing subpar performance to continue, because that has an impact on student learning as well as your staff climate. So we need to be very careful to act in good faith at every stage. And one aspect of good faith involves scrutiny. If we are giving extra scrutiny, if we are giving an extra hard time to anyone, or seen as giving an extra hard time to anyone, that is going to be perceived as unfair. So we have to be very careful to follow processes like the formal PIP process in your district, you know, and following the correct sequence for that, the notifications and everything. You know, everything has to be above board for us to be seen as acting in good faith. And when it comes to the teacher evaluation process itself, all of the teacher-facing steps need to be the same for everyone. We should not be doing extra observations for people that we're suspicious about. We need to be doing the same thing for everyone, whether we're talking about formals, informal observations, classroom walkthroughs, things like that. It needs to be the same for everyone. But what happens behind the scenes is a little bit different. And this is where we have an opportunity, because your behind the scenes work is not visible to anybody else. Nobody knows if you go home and spend 6 hours on an observation report for a teacher who's really struggling. They don't know. Right? That's behind the scenes. That is where you can differentiate your efforts and do what needs to be done in the process while still treating everyone fairly. When you know the evaluation is going to be scrutinized, you know there's going to be some controversy, you really need to think through how to look like you're acting in good faith, as well as actually acting in good faith. And if you want to hear more about this, go into the Principal's HR Toolkit and you will see the decision tree that can help you think through good faith. We talk about that a little bit there, and how to make sure that you're acting in good faith. Because like the thing is, there's an asymmetry problem here. There's an asymmetry of information that is available to the rest of your staff. If you give someone a letter of reprimand and an observation report and a letter of direction, and you give them coaching and you give them feedback, and you let them know and you take steps to help them improve, all of that work is going to be invisible to everyone else. So when they say, ah, Justin gave me a negative evaluation just out of the blue, out of nowhere, they talk to their colleagues and say, what a terrible person you are. They say how unfair and just how out of nowhere this is. And you are not free to say, actually, this is not out of the blue. Here's everything I've done so far. You had a bad observation on this day. I gave you a detailed observation report. I gave you feedback. I gave you support. You can't share any of that with the rest of your staff. So what are you relying on to maintain that sense of goodwill with the rest of your staff? You are relying on your reputation. So fairness needs to be the priority in your reputation. So hopefully these are helpful suggestions in treating everyone fairly, but still being able to differentiate the process. And in the next section, we'll talk about how to use extreme differentiation to free up the time you need to do that behind the scenes work. The 80-20 rule. Extreme Pareto differentiation. Let's talk now about how we can differentiate our time use, especially the time we put in behind the scenes preparing evaluations. We're going to take some inspiration from the Italian economist Vilfredo Pareto, who lived in the 1800s and was an engineer, civil servant, polymath, really studied all kinds of things. But he's most famous for his observation that 80% of the property was owned by 20% of the population in the region that he was looking at. And he started to identify more and more 80-20 distributions in a wide variety of settings. And now this general principle of the 80-20 rule is known as the Pareto principle. And it's not a hard and fast rule, it's just kind of a rule of thumb and a way of recognizing that not all inputs have the same outputs. There are some kind of funky distributions that we can expect in a wide variety of circumstances. And those fall into a couple of different types. One is that 80% of efforts produce only 20% of results, and the other 20% of our efforts have an outsized impact. They produce 80% of our results. A different way of looking at the Pareto principle is in terms of the people, right? If we look at our teachers, we might recognize that only 20% of the people that we're working with cause 80% of the problems. That is probably true for staff performance issues, as well as for student discipline, for difficult parents. 80% of the problems come from 20% of the people, and the other 80% of people only cause 20% of the problems. And that allows us to identify ways that we can optimize how we use our time in the evaluation process. If we think about that 80% of teachers who are probably doing fine, who are low risk, they're not those people that we classified as high risk at the beginning of this module, we can probably find some ways to cut down on wasted time in the evaluation process. In fact, if it weren't for the need for fairness, we could probably skip their evaluations entirely. There is not really any benefit to them or to us in doing those evaluations. You know, if you have someone that you're very confident in, they are doing a great job, you know a lot about their practice, the evaluation itself is not going to really have much impact. So we don't need to spend a lot of time on it. We still need to do it. We still need to treat everyone fairly. We need to not skip any steps, but we can really streamline the process in terms of our behind the scenes work using things like the bucket strategy. The real benefit to our work in evaluations is going to be in addressing those 20% of teachers who are high risk, and especially if any of them end up with negative evaluations. That's where we're going to find about 80% of the impact of the formal evaluation process, and we can streamline the other 80% of evaluations to free up time for those 20%. So as we've mentioned, the bucket strategy is a great way to do that. You can simply reuse your writing for positive evaluations. If someone is satisfactory and someone else is satisfactory in a similar way, all you have to do is provide unique evidence for each person, and you can reuse all of the other aspects of a GSI argument. The generalization can be the same, the impact statement can be the same, and the rating can be the same. All that needs to be different is the evidence, and then of course the unique combination of ratings and buckets that you use to describe someone. That can really save us some time. And we've talked multiple times about the Anna Karenina principle and how, you know, good teachers have a lot in common. Now, what about the way we use time and the 80-20 principle? Let's look at some numbers here. And let's say for the sake of argument that you have 30 teachers that you evaluate. You might have a lot more than 30, you might not have 30. They might be divided up with your admin team in various ways. But let's say for the sake of argument, you have 30 teachers. Let's use the 80-20 rule to divide up those 30 teachers into low risk and high risk. Your numbers might look something like this. Well, 80% of 30 is 24. So those 24 teachers, the 80% of your staff, is going to get 20% of your time and effort in the final evaluation process. The rest of your effort and time, the other 80%, is going to go to just that handful of teachers, 20%, or in this case, six individuals who are high risk. And we don't know at the outset of, you know, kind of determining who's high risk and who's not, who is actually going to end up with a negative evaluation. That remains to be seen, that it depends on the evidence, that depends on how things unfold. But we're going to use that 80-20 rule to differentiate between our high risk and low risk teachers. And if we imagine spending 1 hour per evaluation using the 80-20 rule, here's what that might look like. Rather than say everybody gets exactly 1 hour each, we're going to take that total of 30 hours and think about how to allocate it differentially based on the 80-20 rule. So 24 teachers, 80% of your teachers in 20% of your time means doing their evaluations in just 15 minutes each. And you're probably thinking 15 minutes is not enough time to do a final evaluation. And you're right, it only becomes possible in time if you are using the bucket strategy and if you get kind of efficient with this that you can do evaluations in that amount of time. It's unrealistic to expect that your first evaluation will only take 15 minutes. Your first one might take an hour. Your second one might take 45 minutes. And then as you get to the second half of your staff, you're going to start seeing that time savings from using the bucket strategy. But those high risk teachers may remain time consuming. We don't know necessarily, but we want to be prepared to put in a lot of extra work writing those evaluations and being very thoughtful about our evidence collection. So we might need to allocate 4 hours to each of those six teachers. And then we might need to apply the 80-20 rule a second time. So we can take the top 20% of those six people, which now we get away from whole numbers, but we need to, of course, deal with whole numbers. So this is probably just one or two people who are going to end up with negative evaluations in the final judgment that you are making at the end of the school year. The other high-risk people, you know, their risk is going to get sorted out through information, right? You're going to close those gaps in your own knowledge. You're going to kind of hone in on where their performance is, and they may not need negative evaluations. It might just be zero or one or two people who need to end up with a negative evaluation. And in the next section, we'll talk about how much to take on. We'll talk about picking your battles in the evaluation process. Picking your evaluation battles carefully. When you pursue a negative evaluation, it's very important that you pick your battles carefully and that you make sure that you can win. And a common mistake among new administrators, especially those who've been brought in with a little bit of a mandate to bring about improvement and to address underperforming teachers, a big mistake is to try to take on too much at once. I think at most, you can tackle 1 to 2 negative evaluations per year. And I say that because there are costs. As we've discussed, there are costs in terms of your support from other staff and your staff climate and culture to pursuing a negative evaluation. And we want to make sure that everyone else is able to move forward. And we want to make sure that you are able to make those negative evaluations stick. So never pick a battle you can't win. I think there is an argument to be made for prioritizing easier wins, for example, non-tenured teachers. And if you have cases that are more egregious, certainly those need to be the top priorities. But we want to make sure that we're being smart about this and not relying only on evaluation to address performance issues, and really making sure that when we do a negative evaluation, that it is going to stick. And if we think back to the purposes of evaluation, what does it mean to win? Well, the appropriate next steps need to be initiated for each teacher, whether that teacher is meeting expectations or not. Initiation of appropriate next steps needs to be the primary outcome in addition to the rating itself. So if someone is struggling and they improve, well, that's a win. If there are no further next steps needed because they improved, great. But if they did not improve enough, they need to continue to improve. They may need to ultimately move on, retire, resign, transfer, be fired in some way. If one of those outcomes is what needs to happen for kids because the performance is not where it needs to be and not getting better, well, then we need to be prepared to do what we need to do. But that doesn't always mean pursuing a negative evaluation for each teacher who is struggling in some way. And one example that comes to mind for me is a staff member who was just very, very difficult and was kind of near retirement, was very, very grumpy, did not collaborate, and was in a position where in order to do her job at all, she needed to collaborate with other teachers. It was in a collaborative role, and I won't be more specific than that. But she was just so difficult to work with that nobody wanted to work with her, and she really could not be effective in her job. And what we ended up doing was not a negative evaluation because, you know, she had a lot of, I think, track record, you know, positive evaluations for many years, probably a lot of allies, even though she was not well liked and not easy to work with. Other people would have probably defended her very strongly if I had pursued a negative evaluation. So, you know, we didn't get that far down the road. What I did was I made a slight change to her duties and incorporated some more technology and some things that I knew would be good for students, but that were not her cup of tea. And she started to kind of see the writing on the wall and realize, you know, everything I was doing was defensible. I could act in good faith and saying, hey, we need to bring some computers in, some technology. And that was enough for her to retire. And I'm glad that I approached it that way, because I think she would have had very strong, as I said, peer support if I had tried to do something more negative in terms of the evaluation process. You can predict how strongly teachers will support one of their peers based on a number of factors. If they've been on the staff a long time, and you know, the better liked they are, the more that helps. And in this case, this teacher was not especially well liked. But you know, if they have a strong reputation, lots and lots of years of positive evaluations, if they contribute outside the classroom, if they're the person who always brings donuts, honestly, that is going to make a difference in how well their peers support them and how much they criticize you for a negative evaluation. And, you know, people transform one judgment in one area. You know, like if somebody's nice, if they're warm, if they're friendly, if they bring donuts, you know, people have kind of a halo effect in judging their peers, and they think, well, that's a nice person, they must be a good teacher. Well, we know that's not always the case. So it is very, very difficult to get rid of a nice person or even to give them a not very nice evaluation, even if they deserve it. So factor that in to your decision making and be ready for criticism if you do have to address poor performance in a nice person. You also want to remember that harassment is not a strategy. The changes that I made to increase the technology in one teacher's workload were very defensible. They could not be portrayed as harassment. And for that reason, I was able to make those changes while still maintaining the appearance of acting in good faith. And, you know, promoting that voluntary resignation or that retirement worked because it was not harassment. You want to be very careful to avoid behaviors like these that could be seen as harassment, such as changing someone's assignment for no particular reason, right? If someone has been teaching a particular course or grade level for years, and you suddenly say, well, actually, I think we're going to move you, and it's obviously kind of punitive and designed to get them to quit, well, that is going to reflect poorly on you and is going to prompt wagon circling behavior from colleagues. If you add extra steps that are not built into the evaluation process for that person, if you make it harder for them to complete their evaluation process and that's not justified by the process itself, then that is going to come back to bite you. If you are judging them unfairly, if you have obviously stricter standards for that person, then that is going to reflect poorly on you. And if there is any indication of any kind of inner circle or favoritism, that is not going to look good for you. And what you're going to see from teachers is what I call wagon circling behavior. People will circle the wagons against you. They will surround the person that you are giving a negative evaluation to, or that they think you might be giving a negative evaluation to, and they will defend that person almost to the death. It's really a remarkable thing to see. Again, even if they know that that person is not getting it done, they're not doing a good job, their colleagues will rally to their defense because, again, they know they could be next if people are not being evaluated in good faith. So we want to show good faith. We want to show that the process is fair and consistent for everyone, that when deficiencies are identified, there is a genuine opportunity to improve. People want to know that they are not going to be targeted or singled out, that there's not some inner circle that they're being left out of, and that this is not just about being a favorite or a personality conflict, but really that this is about teacher practice and performance. So do everything you can to act in good faith, to do the hard things that need to be done in the evaluation process, and to make that as obviously clear and fair to everyone as you can. And in the next section, we'll talk about what remains unfinished after the evaluation process. Loose ends, when performance issues remain unresolved. So we've come to the end of the evidence-driven teacher evaluation certification program, and I've given you lots of strategies for improving your evaluation process while also working with the process that's been outlined in your district by policy and procedure. And we want to, of course, do everything we can within that process to improve teacher performance, but we also need to recognize that teacher evaluations have a limited ability to actually change things. Teacher evaluations are not going to solve all problems. What they can do is they can initiate the appropriate next steps for each teacher and give each teacher an accurate rating, but we're going to have to do other things to help people improve. And sometimes we forget that. Sometimes we think the evaluation process is the be-all end-all. So if we have a problem that we need to solve, we try to solve it by putting more and more and more effort into the evaluation process itself. And one of the messages that I hope people take away from this module is that that does not necessarily work. We don't need to double down on the time we're putting into the evaluation process as long as we are doing what's necessary to initiate those next steps. And for your high-risk teachers, they legitimately do take more time. So we want to use the 80-20 principle to allocate that time differentially behind the scenes to the evaluations that need it. But we also, of course, need to recognize that that by itself is not going to bring about improvement. We're going to have to do a variety of other things to bring about improvement and help people grow. Things like professional development, whether that is school-based or outside of the school. You know, we may need to send people to training, send people to outside workshops, provide coaching and mentoring support. You know, these are things that happen beyond the evaluation process, but that can be initiated by the teacher evaluation process. And the evaluation process can be kind of the first line in the sand that says, this is not good enough. We really need to see improvement. We really need to see action. And of course, the evaluation process can trigger human resources processes that can further bolster those actions and really prompt action that may have been too long in coming. Things like a performance improvement plan. Again, work with your human resources department and your supervisor on each of these, but we have resources in the Principal's HR Toolkit for performance improvement plans, letters of reprimand, which are for addressing things that are not in your evaluation criteria, but are of concern as far as adult behavior. And the peer observation protocol can also be part of your efforts to help people improve. And then if all of that fails and someone is staying on your staff, it is always an option to change people's duties a little or a lot, as we talked about in the last section. You know, sometimes people are in a job that is just not a good fit for their skills. And it's not that they couldn't do any job on staff, but maybe they're working with a grade level that's just not a good fit for them. Or maybe they are in an assignment that has a scope of responsibilities that's challenging for them. So consider that possibility of changing responsibilities, moving people into different roles if they are going to stay on your staff. And when in doubt, ask for help. Anything beyond the evaluation process itself is something to definitely talk to your supervisor about, to talk to human resources. You may even have legal counsel involved in high-stakes teacher evaluations and what happens after a negative evaluation. So don't hesitate to reach out to those people in your organization. And don't hesitate to reach out to me if I can be of assistance. You can email me anytime, justin@principalcenter.com, and I'm happy to discuss it with you. In the next section, we'll wrap things up with our Module 5 portfolio task. Here's your Module 5 portfolio task: to write 2 GSIR final evaluations. Now that we've reached the end of the Evidence-Driven Teacher Evaluation Certification Program, it's time to talk about how to actually earn your certification. We will send you your certificate in the mail when you successfully complete all of the portfolio tasks. And just to review them by module, you'll find each of these tasks at the end of the respective module. In Module 1, I asked you to identify the 3 forms of accountability that are built into your goal setting process in terms of process accountability, performance accountability, and outcome accountability, because Module 1 was all about goal setting and the different types of accountability. In Module 2, I asked you to identify the teacher evaluation criteria and framework or system that's used in your organization, whether that is something that you've developed in-house or whether you use one of the well-known systems like the Danielson framework. Go ahead and send that to me if you've not already done so. In Module 3, I asked you to submit 2 reflections on the expectations that you're dealing with in the evaluation process. So see the end of Module 3 for details on those. In Module 4, I asked you to send in the teacher evaluation organizer spreadsheet with your buckets on it. So if you haven't done that, you can do that now as well. And now for your Module 5 task, I would like you to send me 2 complete GSIR final evaluations, 1 for a low-risk teacher and 1 for a high-risk teacher. Now, neither one of these needs to be unsatisfactory. They can both be satisfactory. But the reason I'm asking for a low-risk and a high-risk evaluation is so that you have the opportunity to reflect on that 80-20 Pareto principle differentiation, where you're putting significantly more time and effort in behind the scenes on that high-risk evaluation, and you're conducting that low-risk evaluation much more quickly and much more efficiently using the bucket strategy. So here is what to do. Send me two of your final evaluations, and you can send these in at any time, whenever it's convenient for you. So if you're going through this program earlier in the school year, and it will be some time until you complete final evaluations, just do this at the end of the year or over the summer after those evaluations are done, and we can send you your certificate then. If you want to use the final evaluation builder, that can be a substantial time saver and can also help you structure your thinking. So that is optional, but you know, you might come up with a very similar looking final evaluation, even if you don't use the final evaluation builder, but it is a great tool, and you can find that at principalcenter.com/builder as a template in our repertoire app. But however you write your final evaluations, when you're ready, send them to me at justin@principalcenter.com, and I will go through and compile all the different aspects that you've sent me of your portfolio. And when everything is in place, we will send you your certificate in the mail and congratulate you for finishing the Evidence-Driven Teacher Evaluation Certification Program. So I want to thank you for going through this program with me and congratulate you on finishing it. And if you're interested in our other flagship program on instructional leadership, that is called the Evidence-Driven Classroom Walkthrough Certification Program. And that focuses on, of course, classroom walkthroughs and that daily habit of getting into classrooms and having feedback conversations with teachers. So if you're a Navigator member, you have access to that. And if you don't have access to that, just let us know if you're interested and we can talk about how to make that happen. That is it, again, for the Evidence-Driven Teacher Evaluation Certification Program. I'm Justin Bader, and I want to thank you again for going through this program with me. Take care.